1st. It is primary day. You have less than 24 hours to get those ballots in. There's a lot at stake, too, among the big races. Who will lead Washington State for the next 4 years? Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott looks at the big names in a crowded race for governor.
There are dozens of people challenging Jay Inslee, who's running for a third term in a time filled with more turmoil than most of us have ever experienced. It's a tough gig, to say the least, but one Governor Inslee believes he's still the right person for, citing his leadership on the two main issues gripping not only the nation and the state, but the world right now. And of course, pointing to what he sees as the failures of the other side.
The other party's fallen Donald Trump over a cliff, who calls COVID a hoax. Still believes in magic hocus pocus and is leading this country to a ruinous failure to deal with this pandemic with a lack of national leadership. And every single one of the candidates we're running against is following Donald Trump, frankly. So there couldn't be more at stake tonight. And we know the timeliness of our efforts for justice is never more important. I'm proud to say that we have started our task force to try to improve police accountability, a first step to the many things we need to do to root out systemic racism.
In the very crowded race, really only six challengers considered to have a shot, including anti-tax advocate and frequent initiative filer Tim Iman, who recently spoke to Cairo Radio's Gian Ursula.
You absolutely have to make judgments on what is best for the people of the state of Washington. You have to have safety, you have to have liberty, and you have to have a strong economy. If you don't have all three, you don't have a functioning government. What Jay Inslee did is he suspended liberty, suspended the strong economy, and the question is, did that make us more safe? And it's like, no, he shattered our economy to where we used to have $53 billion to spend. Now it looks like we may have just as little as $40 billion to spend, and that's less money that we have for public health, education, all the things that are important. He really threw a monkey wrench into this entire process, and I think what we need to do is open up Washington, make things where it's persuading people, not ordering people around. I think that's a better approach, and I think it's certainly more in line with the value system that most Washingtonians have, which is the government is there to serve us, not the other way around.
Also in the hunt, Anton Sakharov, who tells KTTH's Jason Rantz, despite being lower in the poll numbers, he still has a shot. State Republican Senator Phil Fortunato, also in the mix, says for what he has to offer.
The Supreme Court said you can't get homeless people off the street unless there's a place for them to go. And I drafted a bill called the Shelter Act, where you give them a secure area. You fence an area in, you give them a tent, you give them a sleeping bag. You have social services, mental health counseling, drug and alcohol counseling, and you have a police presence.
Then there's America's top cop and Republic Police Chief Lauren Culp, who started making headlines a couple of years back when he declared he would not enforce new voter-approved gun laws in Washington, a trend that's continued when it comes to the pandemic restrictions that he has no intention of wavering on should he be elected.
I will have press conferences with the medical professionals to get the information out, and then let free individual Washington residents decide what's best for themselves, their family, and their business.
Bothell politician Josh Fried, also a contender, and has issues with much of what Inslee has done during the pandemic that he plans to change should he take the win.
We have to cut the state budget by 20 to 25%. We have to make difficult decisions at state level because, you know, individuals at home are making those decisions, pay the mortgage, pay the rent, or buy the groceries. And that's the reality. We have to cut the state budget by 20 to 25%. We have to make difficult decisions at state level because, you know, individuals at home are making those decisions, pay the mortgage, pay the rent, or buy the groceries. And that's the reality.
Finally, newcomer and Yakima doctor Raul Garcia has made up some ground despite joining the race later than most.
What really, really got to me was that one branch of government decided that they were going to rule and mandate and dictate and not educate without any checks and balances. That reminded me a lot of Cuba, where I came from. I know what big government is. I lived it. My grandfather had his farm taken from him by the government, and we were brainwashed as kids.
State Republican Chair Caleb Heimlich believes the people of Washington are frustrated and ready for a big change at the top, and he likes the choices available.
Republican voters in Washington State, and I'd say even independents and some soft Democrats, have a lot of options when it comes to the governor's race. If you're happy with the direction of the state, you can vote for four more years of Jay Inslee. I mean, he's running for an unprecedented third term. I think he's had a a record that isn't deserving of four more years. And so if you're looking for an alternative, you have many, many options.
But State Democratic Party Chair Tina Podlodowski feels plenty confident, especially when you look at the big picture.
Thinking about other people, look, mask up, right? It's like it's a very simple thing to put on a mask to make sure that you're taking care of other people and not spreading the virus. But still, we have people, most notably Republicans, who at the beginning of the pandemic were intransigent about that and not wanting to do that. We still have Republican candidates right now for the state legislature who are out there door knocking without a mask, putting people at risk. All of that is something that I just think the public is fed up with, and they want to see something different at the federal level, and they're happy with who they have in their governor.
And Hannah joins us live now. Hannah, I imagine a lot of the candidates are going to be meeting virtually for the watch parties tonight.
Yes, and actually there's some fundraisers going on, and some candidates aren't even doing get-togethers. And in some places you'll have, you know, you're not supposed to have more than a couple of people together. So for the most part, I'm touching base with people by phone later tonight. Definitely most people monitoring the social, following the social distancing rules. Those that maybe don't believe in it, just in case they don't want to put off the wrong impression for the voters.
Sure. It's hard to know if there's an appetite for change at the top during a pandemic, or if status quo is safer. Are any of the polls indicating that Governor Inslee does not have a chance for reelection?
I have not seen any poll that has him not having a chance, for sure. I think most of the polls that I've seen are having between 55% to 60% of the vote. And, you know, this is the primary. I think there's probably zero chance that he doesn't come out on the top two in the primary, for sure. And I think most people expect him to win. The state Republicans think that they maybe have a shot. They like a couple of those candidates. At this point, though, it's primary. They want to wait and see who comes out on the top two and see what they have to work with over the next, 90 days until November.
Who's in the lead outside of Governor Inslee?
I think the favorites are going to be Josh Fried is definitely seen as a favorite. I think Raul Garcia, though, the Yakima doctor, who really just kind of connected with people when he got into the race and some of his engagements with them. He's seen some decent numbers. So there's that. And there's always the wild card, Tim Iman. You never know.
All right. Thank you, Hannah. Appreciate it.
You bet.
The Boeing 737 MAX could be flying again by the end of the year. The FAA has published its list of design changes that must be completed, and Chris is here with a look at what has to be done.
Well, it's a pretty large laundry list, as you would imagine, of requirements that Boeing must make before the MAX can get back in the air. The first, of course, is the software changes to the flight control systems that were at the heart of the two deadly crashes. Boeing must install a second angle of attack sensor on the plane so that the computers will have more data points to use. The FAA also wants a new alert in the cockpit that will let pilots know if those sensors disagree. The agency also wants Boeing to rewire the plane's horizontal stabilizer electrical system. This should prevent any accidental arcing or shorting that could impact the horizontal tail. The FAA will also require that a vital pilot emergency checklist be revised to make it easier for pilots to work through. In one of the two deadly crashes, the pilots could not work their way through that manual in a way that allowed them to save the plane. Now, once this list is published to the Federal Register in a couple of days, that's going to start a 45-day public comment period on these proposed design changes. Anybody can comment, including the public, on this. But this change is really designed for airplanes, airline owners, experts to look at the changes, make their suggestions about this. If all goes according to plan, the FAA is expected to clear the MAX for flying in October, but that's not the end. Boeing and its MAX customers must then make the necessary changes. They must test their airplanes. Each jet must perform a readiness flight before passengers are allowed on board. And the FAA is also still working on a report on pilot training. Haven't gotten that yet. This is the one that will most likely include a lot more training, perhaps some simulator time for MAX pilots to give them a better handle of how this new plane operates.
Well, all by the end of the year?
That's what and again, we're not talking about getting the entire fleet back up and running. I mean, if we could get a couple of passenger jets from some airplanes up, that would be great. I mean, that's the plan, is to get some passenger service back on the MAX before the end of the year. But again, it all depends on how you know, the airlines are comfortable with making those changes, making those readiness flights. Mm-hmm. And then also we have the international customers that still want to go and give this a once over. They're not going to rubber stamp these FAA changes like they have in the past. Mm-hmm. They want to make sure Europeans or the Canadians, they want to make sure that the fixes are good for what they believe as well.
And then there's the appetite for
the public
flying again, right? Yeah. Not just, you know, getting on to a 737 MAX, but flying in a pandemic or even at the tail end of a pandemic.
Exactly.
So Boeing, you know, it's a double whammy for Boeing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, these last 18 months have been unprecedented for them in terms of the challenges. And this is a company that's not new to challenges. I mean, let's not forget the 87, you know, things that, with the delays there and whatnot with the battery fires. So, yeah, it's been unprecedented.
And, you know, I feel for all the Boeing workers out there who, you know, may be listening. It must be a stressful time to wonder, you know, will you have a job in a month? Will you have a job in 6 months as the company surely looks towards South Carolina for production?
Well, that and I mean, I've got a Boeing employee in the family.
I know.
Who I come home to every day and ask, you know, have you heard anything? Is there anything going on? Yeah. And I know there are lots of families that are doing that exact same thing every day because more layoffs are expected.
All right. Thank you, Chris. We'll stay on top of the Boeing news for you. Your daily dose of kindness now sponsored by Mike Novak and listwithnovak.com. It hits close to home for me. Have you had this experience, Sully? As a little girl when I had my bike stolen.
I wasn't a little girl, but yes, I've had my bike stolen. Yes.
I'll never forget it. It was such a violating feeling. I left it on the side of our home and within a night it was gone. It was a hard lesson in the realities of the world for my young self. Well, 7-year-old Brian Jeffrey of Little Rock, Arkansas, had his bike swiped on July 14th while he was inside a store with his sister. It had been a Christmas gift, a Batman bike. It was his prized possession. Well, fortunately for Brian, Detective Tim Gray turned into his personal Batman. The officer said he knew he had to do something when a stolen bike case came across his desk.
I thought, you know, nobody takes a little boy's bike. I thought, I'm just going to buy him another bicycle.
He got some help from the community. They got the exact bike that was stolen, set up a bouncy house, held a parade for the young boy who was shocked, surprised, and grateful as tears started to flow.
He surprised me with a new bike, and it looks just like my old one.
Just his reaction was priceless. It must have been some dust in the air because my eyes watered up a little bit.
It's called crying detective. Mom says this was a lesson in kindness for everyone.
It just showed him that, hey, man, somebody can make your day great. Every negative situation does not always stay negative.
And actually, the original bike eventually turned up. Whoever stole it returned it to the same spot where they took it. Detective Gray lifted some fingerprints, but the search was unsuccessful. No matter.
Did you get your bike back?
No, I never did. And my parents refused to buy me a new one because of my irresponsibility of leaving it on the side of that.
Turns out my brother took it.
Oh,
my
really?
Yeah.
Your brother took it?
Yeah.
Where did he go?
It turned out to be, you know, he was just messing with me. So yeah. I guess you can't really say it was stolen. But
right.
Yeah.
But you thought for a minute.
Yeah,
your
I was
heart
like,
dropped.
Oh, my gosh, where did it go? It wasn't where it normally should be. Me and my banana seat. Where was it? Where was it going?
I don't remember what mine looked. I think it was green or something. I can't remember.
Red
I'm sure my mom
seat.
And dad are listening right now. You did the right thing teaching me a lesson. It taught me responsibility to not buy me that bike again. So thank you for that lesson. Now it's time to talk with G. Scott from the G. and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon here on Cairo Radio. How you doing, G.?
Good morning, everybody. Good morning. Who you got with you?
I got Sully here.
Okay, good morning, Sully.
I'm back in the anchor desk. Two more days.
All right, there you go. There you go.
So. Are you still positive that the Seahawks are going to have a season?
Oh, yes.
Yes?
Yes, the NFL will play football.
Okay, and we heard from Coach Carroll finally.
What do you think? We don't bubble like the NBA did or like the NHL did in the same fashion, but don't think for a second that we aren't in a bubble. We are, and that bubble is the conscience that we can hold. You know, always protect the team. Rule number one is in effect. It's crucial we do a great job with this.
So that sounds good, too.
Does sound good. And when you hear Pete Carroll say that, when I hear Pete Carroll say that, there's so much emotion that kind of sparks inside of me, because a lot of people, when you hear that, you might think like, oh, well, there's Pete Carroll being Pete Carroll. But I know that no, That's really Pete Carroll, and that's really how he does things. You see, guys, people that leave Seattle, people that leave the Seahawks and go play at other teams, they tell me all the time, man, it is nowhere near the same. There is the amount of love that happens at the VMAC, at that practice facility, and what Pete Carroll has brought and facilitates consistently is different than any other situation that I've been in my entire life. I've been part of the Seattle Seahawks for 17 years, guys. 17 years. I was there when Pete Carroll showed up in 2010. I was there when there was a lot of people who was like, oh, he's going to come. It's not going to be good. Who's this Pete Carroll guy? I was there after the first couple practices when Pete Carroll was playing music, and a lot of the veteran players thought it was corny, and they talked about how that's not real NFL stuff, and they only play music in college and how it doesn't work. Now today, all NFL teams play music at their practices.
Interesting.
Pete Carroll is a different dude that I've never met. And so what if I told you guys this, right? What if I told you that when Pete Carroll came there in 2010, the guy that was washing cars, somehow, some way, he got a little bit of that juice of some of that championship love and some of that good attitude and some of that positive stuff. And then every single day at around 7:45 on Seattle Mornings News, that he's talking to you guys.
I know. I believe it, G. It's your story, and it's really a remarkable one. I'm happy you met Pete and you got some of that love. Sully.
Yeah, I got a question for you, G. I know you're super confident in the NFL having a season. I tend to agree with you based on the dollars and cents. How do you control the players in terms of doing what they're supposed to? We've got reports now out of L.A. where an NFL player, we're trying to find out who it was, had a huge party at a mansion. They rented it as an Airbnb. You know, there's a potential exposure there you bring back to your team and into the locker room. Well, it's, you know, how do you, I mean, I guess that could be any job or anything, but in the NFL, how do you prevent that?
You don't prevent it. You said it yourself right there, Sully. It's just like the same with our job. Like when you, Sully, leave and Colleen leaves and I leave and I go and we're not at work, what we do is what we do. There is nobody that's going to really tell us what we do. I mean, we are still sitting here arguing about if you should wear a mask or not. So it's not necessarily a profession. You can't control a profession, NFL being a profession on what they do. All I know is this. It is a little easier for college football players to do the right thing than it is for maybe NFL players to do the right thing is because, well, it comes down to money. I mean, I talk to my son every single day, and one of the pressures for him and his friends is you don't want to be the one to catch the coronavirus. So you want to be the one that goes to the practice facility and comes right back to your apartment because you want to do the right thing, because the upperclassmen are looking at you, because there's upperclassmen on the team that are like, hey, man, I need this season and you can't be messing it up for us. My son now has been tested 11 times for the coronavirus since the beginning of June. Let me repeat that. He's been tested 11 times. He will continue to get tested every 2 days. So, one, there is great protocol at Ohio State when it comes to the COVID, but you can't protect anything, because my son, if he wanted to, he could still go to a little party that they're having out there in Columbus. He could still do those things. So there's kind of a pressure, whereas someone who is, let's say, someone who makes $500,000 a year, $600,000 a year, $5 million a year, I don't know. It's a little tough. You can tell them what to do and what not to do.
If only every employer had that capability to test so well. I mean, more people could get back to work.
Yeah, I'm more.
Why are you laughing, Gene?
No, because I thought you were going somewhere else with there. Because I thought you were going with if the, you know, that's why we got more cases, because there's more tests.
Well, you want to talk about the president's interview with
Axios?
I got one thing to raise with you, G. Just what's your concern level? Because what for G? Because for Tommy, Tommy's in the dorm at Montana State. And my concern is when the kids come back, he's going to be in a situation where when he might get infected by someone coming in to go to class, when he's been basically in a bubble for the last month and a half there in Bozeman.
I think that's tough, right? I think that's really tough to control that. And hence the reason why a decision is going to be made here about some of, like, you know, some other, like D1 Power 5, D1 football, Those, I think that they'll play because there's just way too much money that's involved that they bring in. But some of these situations where your son, Sully, is in a dorm and then there's going to be kids coming back that is going to be mingling with. And yes, the chances of COVID, them catching that is higher probability of that. Whereas some of these bigger schools, they now have their own apartments now, you know, so.
All right. Wow. Gee, I guess we didn't have time to talk about the president's interview.
I'm glad.
People can go to Twitter and follow you if they want to know your thoughts on that. All right. Talk to you tomorrow.
See you guys.
Tuesday mornings, we dial up Pulitzer Prize winning Washington Post reporter David Farenthold. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm great. I'm on vacation this week, so I'm doing especially well.
That's right. You're in Cape Cod. Has the hurricane reached you?
No, not yet. I think it's still hitting Washington, D.C., so this is an especially good day not to be in Washington, D.C.
Are you going to get any of the hurricane or any of the remnants?
A little bit. They're talking about a few inches of rain here, but nothing nothing really hurricane-like.
It's good to be on vacation. Is that helping with the mental stress of this pandemic?
Yes, it is. We're seeing my in-laws, so it's really nice to be able to see other people. Yeah. But we're still trying to avoid seeing any other people beyond people we're related to.
Have you seen the president's Axios interview, or are you watching any of that while on vacation?
I have seen some excerpts of it from this morning. It's hard to say anything shocks you now, but it seems kind of shocking.
Yeah, I'm not sure why his campaign keeps allowing these interviews. I mean, you can think the president's doing a good job and also agree that he's not doing the best at these interviews from CBS News to Fox News and now Axios. I'm not seeing anything good coming out of these interviews.
No, they're certainly not. I mean, one of those striking things about this morning was that they seem to have tried to prepare him to talk about the pandemic by giving him some sort of graphs on pieces of paper about, you know, ways in which you could slice up the data on the pandemic and show that the U.S. is doing better than other countries. But when Jonathan Swan, the interviewer, pushed back and said, well, you know, what about other metrics? I mean, for instance, he said, you know, the deaths per capita and cases per capita in the U.S. are so much higher than they are in basically every other industrialized country. We're doing so much worse by those metrics. And Trump said, you can't do that. And the interviewer said, what do you mean I can't do that? Basically, Trump was like, I've been only given a few statistics to talk about, and that's not one of those, so I'm not going to talk about it.
Or you can only talk about the numbers that make me look good.
Totally. And it made Trump look like he was not in command of this thing that supposedly he spent the last few months focused on.
Sure enough. Do we know how the Republican Party is either thinking about another President Trump? Or I don't know, just to me, it seems these interviews are not doing him any favors. Is this the, you know, Republican Party trying to suss out if they need another candidate to come forward?
That's a good question. From what our reporting, it seems to indicate that the people who are around Trump now, you know, after 3.5 years in office, it's people who just tell him yes and tell him he's great and he's doing a great job and keep bad information from him. And so I think it's less that this is any sort of strategy to make Trump look bad so they can replace him, and more just the outcome of a strategy where people minimize Trump getting mad at them inside the White House. And so just tell him he's doing great. So he then is unprepared for situations like this where he's not dealing with a sycophant.
Sure. Now, you've been covering the president's business and charities for a few years now, and your latest piece is a look at some financial disclosures from the White House. What did you find?
These are basically once a year the president has to release personal financial disclosures, and it's the best snapshot. It's not a great snapshot, but it's the best snapshot we've got about how his businesses are doing year to year. And this one was from covered calendar year 2019, showed the revenue for all his various businesses. Basically, it seemed like his businesses were pretty flat in 2019. They didn't go up, but they didn't really go down very much like they had in previous years. The problem for Trump is, you know, that's relatively good news for his business. But since the end of that calendar year 2019, of course, the COVID-19 pandemic has slammed all of his businesses, especially the ones that are dependent on luxury travel. U.S. luxury travel, conference travel business is, you know, really cooked, and it's going to be that way for several years. And Trump really depends on that business. So even though it seemed like 2019 was a pretty good year for the Trump organization, we're certain 2020 has been a really terrible one.
Well, certainly his stays and the Secret Service that need hotel rooms have been helping out just a bit. Did you ever get to the bottom of how much he was charging the taxpayers to let Secret Service stay at his hotels?
Well, there's still a lot more I want to know. We've sued the Secret Service for some documents they haven't provided us yet. We're trying to get a bunch more documents. But here's what I can tell you. The Trump organization had said that when the Secret Service comes with their father, it comes with President Trump and stays at Trump properties, this Trump organization charges just $50. That's what they said, $50 a room. Well, I've now looked at hundreds and hundreds of hotel room receipts and have not found even one case where that was true. In every case, the actual rate they charged was much, much higher than they were saying in public. Mm. It went as high as $650 a night for hotel rooms at Mar-a-Lago. That's for each room. And $17,000 a month for a condo or a cottage they rent to the Secret Service in Bedminster. So thousands, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cases, not a single one that matched what they said they were doing.
Maybe they don't know. Maybe they don't know how much they charged, you know?
Hey, it's not that big of a company. It's not like Marriott. You know, these are It's a relatively small company. I don't think that they would be that high up that they wouldn't know what they were charging the Secret Service, or that they'd be off by a factor of whatever, you know, $650 versus $50.
You know who's been relatively quiet? Joe Biden.
Yeah, it's interesting. It seems to be working for him, but yes, he has been very quiet.
That's what it's an interesting strategy to have President Trump do all these interviews and to have former Vice President Biden stay so quiet. And we were expecting his VP pick this week, but he's pushed that off. Do you know why?
No, I mean, you've read a lot of speculation about, you know, who his different choices are and that there's people emerging. You know, the latest sort of dark horse candidates were Susan Rice, Obama's former national security advisor, Karen Bass, a congresswoman from California. To me, it seems like there's only a couple people who really make sense. Kamala Harris, the senator from California, Tammy Duckworth, the senator from Illinois. If Biden has said he wants to choose an experienced woman, I think those two they sort of stand head and shoulders above the other candidates.
That's a different strategy than usual. Typically, the VP is somebody who will, you know, not make headlines, not take the spotlight away from the president. But it seems Biden is happy to have the vice president be at least an equal.
I think that's right. I mean, I think Biden recognizes that one of the knocks on him is age, that you know, people are afraid of him. I think it's what will make it hard for somebody like Elizabeth Warren, who's almost as old as Biden is, to get this choice. You know, they want somebody with Biden who is much younger, you know, with the idea that if Biden, you know, gets sick or dies in office, that there's somebody who's there to take his place, somebody qualified and ready to go. So, you know, who knows? Who knows what Biden's going to choose? I think I don't know if this is the reason, but there is a political benefit in waiting, and that, like, Donald Trump seems to be getting up every morning and hurting himself in the polls. So if you're Biden, why would you step on that? You know, why wouldn't you wait a little bit longer to use this at a time when you need some attention?
Yeah, don't draw attention away from the fact that this Axios interview has dropped. If you were putting money on the VP pick, who would you think Biden's going to go for?
I would choose Harris. I think Duckworth is also a really good candidate and would bring a lot to the table. But Harris seems like the most, like, she checks all the boxes and seems very presidential, I think. And there's also, you've read the most criticism of her from people inside Biden's inner circle, which to me suggests that she's the front runner. People feel like they need to go public with their criticism of her.
I see. All right. David Farenthold from The Washington Post. Enjoy Cape Cod. I can hear your kids in the background enjoying themselves. So it sounds like a great vacation.
Thank you.
All right. Talk to you next week.
Let's go.
Time for Choke Points. What should you do if you find your trailhead parking lot full, which apparently a lot of people are doing these days with everybody going outdoors, or if the few spots for your favorite river float are full? You should find another place to go. What you should not do is park on the highway. It's become a big problem this year, and it's making a dangerous road even worse. Chris, what's going on?
Well, you know, this is something that Holly and I, my wife and I, came across when we went hiking up at the Coal Creek Parkway, up in the Coal Creek Mountain up there a couple weeks back. We went there, the trailhead was full. People were kind of scrambling around trying to figure out what to do. There's really no place to park there. So we, you know, found an alternate and worked our way around. And that's really the key here is if it's so busy that the parking lot is full, go somewhere else. One, because, you know, for safety reasons, you want to try to social distance. You don't want to go into a jammed place anyway. And then what we're finding along Highway 2, which has some of the really cool places you can dip in and out of, you know, for hiking or swimming or running falls or floating, things like that, is that it's making one of the most dangerous highways in the state even more so. If you've been up to Highway 2 at all, you know that, you know, coming back home on a Sunday is virtually impossible. Mm-hmm. The neighbors are trapped in their homes because they can't get out of their driveways or out of their streets. And this year it's become even worse, especially near Eagle Falls, where people are simply parking their cars on the shoulder of the highway, sometimes two cars deep, in front of what are clearly marked no parking signs.
Troopers are seeing just about every type of way of parking, diagonal parking,
pulling straight in perpendicular to the roadway, pulling in horizontally to the roadway, and then people double stacking and parking like that. I mean, it's just pretty insane.
State Trooper Anthony Reese says a lot of the cars actually stick out into the highway, which are forcing people to veer into oncoming traffic to get around them. And while this is happening, people are carrying kayaks on the highway, taking up space on the road. Children are running across the highway. Mm. And a reminder, this is a 60-mile-an-hour road.
It used to kind of be a pretty quiet, secluded, just a spot where locals mainly knew about it. Over the years, it has gotten more and more busy. 2020 has definitely been the year where it's by far been the worst.
Well, it could be cliche to say social media is driving the attention. It kind of is. There were so many videos out there of people having fun around Eagle Falls that people are going there to kind of check things out. This has also caused problems for emergency vehicles responding to problems at Eagle Falls. One person has died already this year in the rapids. Last week, another man disappeared and is presumed to have died. Yeah. There was a group rescue, you know, last month as well. And with people blocking the shoulder with their cars, there is no place for the medics to park for these emergencies, so they have to block the highway, which makes it even worse. Trooper Reese says they've tried the nice approach so far, which is educating drivers when they find them instead of ticketing them. And he says ticketing can be difficult. They just don't want to ticket the car. They want to ticket the person. And to do that, they've got to go for a hike.
To park there for a prolonged period of time, go down to the falls themselves and try to ask, oh, who's driving the blue Honda Civic with this license plate, and try to find the driver in order to ticket them?
Just isn't efficient. So they're coming with the hammer. They're towing.
We're resulting to towing vehicles from the tow-away zones, and then going to have to go about it that route now.
But that also adds congestion, because the tow trucks have to block the traffic because there's no room on the shoulder for them to do what they need to do. State Department of Transportation has added some large no parking signs. You know, we're talking like the big construction side flashing no parking along Highway 2. No one seems to be paying attention. They're also trying to find some spots that have a little bit more shoulder where they can kind of direct people to park illegally. Mm-hmm. So if you're heading out to your favorite spot, as I mentioned, follow this rule. If the parking lot is full, go somewhere else. Have an extra plan. Plenty of spots to check out, and for no reason should you ever park on the side of the highway unless it's an emergency. You know, when I did the choke point earlier this morning, I got a text from somebody out in the Snoqualmie Falls area. It says happened in the same place on SR 202, right at the bottom of Snoqualmie Falls Hill. People are parking there on the side and carrying kayaks and boats, and there's a giant curve there, and they're worried somebody's going to get hit there, because I mean, everybody wants to get out. We're all stir crazy. Mm-hmm. I get that, but there's no reason to park on the side of the highway. One, it's dangerous for you, it's dangerous for others, and if somebody gets in trouble, there's no place for the emergency responders to show up.
Yeah.
Don't be selfish.
You can, I mentioned this before, the WTA.org, Washington Trails Association, where you can search for more of those obscure spots, not so popular, because for me, the joy of being outdoors is ruined when you've got people parking along the highway and it's so crowded that you can't get some alone time with nature, that you can't hear the sounds of nature. So it probably is a good idea, considering everybody is heading out now. Recreating is even more popular in this pandemic, to check out those websites that will take you to the less popular areas so you can socially distance and enjoy nature.
Or, as you had talked about earlier, having a couple of backup plans.
Yeah.
If the falls you are going to visit are busy, maybe go to that obscure place, or maybe take the lesser hike or the more challenging hike that you decide to blow off till later. Have a couple of different places you can go. But, yeah, I mean, you don't want busy trails, and you don't want to put yourself in danger or others in danger.
Might be worth it to take the ferry over to the Olympics, which is, you know, not as accessible as the Cascades, but certainly less people would be over there, I assume, you know, just given the access to the area. The Olympics are, I mean, I grew up in the shadow of the Cascades in Marysville, so big fan. But, you know, I've been spending some more time camping and recreating over in the Olympics. Oh, my, is that a hidden gem, that rainforest.
But the double whammy here is people are trying to, or we're encouraging them to kind of stay close to home. And we have so many gems that are so close.
Well, you can wear your mask on the ferry. I know the ferry is having issues with that.
You should go further out. I agree. There are places to go without hitting Rattlesnake Ridge.
You can stay in your car. You don't have to be around people. You can do this safely. Just be smart about it. All right, Sully, good advice. Thank you for that. You can ring my Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien along with Chris Sullivan. And Rachel Bell has a brand new Your Last Meal podcast and she has a preview for us.
There are many ways to say I love you.
Yeah, if you've never listened to the podcast, just a quick elevator pitch. I interview celebrities about what they would choose to eat for their last meal, and then we go into the history, the science, the culture of that dish. So my latest guest is Francois Clemens. That is who you hear singing right now.
I love you. There's a singing way.
You may recognize this song because it was sung often on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. So Francois Clemens played Officer Clemens on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood for 25 years, from 1968 to 1993. And one of the most famous images of him and his very dear friend Fred Rogers is the two of them sitting with their feet in a baby pool on the set. And this was in 1968, 1969, at a time when in public pools around the country, a lot of white people didn't want black people using the public pools. And so this image of this white man and this black man sharing the pool, Mr. Rogers drying his feet off when he gets out, was very poignant and something that you didn't see at that time.
Even to this day, watching it is emotional.
It is. And that is the cover of Francois Clemens' new memoir, is that picture. Wow. So Francois is also an opera singer. He's an incredible person. He won a Grammy for a recording of Porgy and Bess, and he directed the Martin Luther King Spiritual Choir at Middlebury College until he retired. So Mr. Rogers and Francois Clemens became very, very close. And Francois came from a violent household. He had an abusive father. He is gay, he is black, all of these things that were not easy in the 1960s. And he met Mr. Rogers, and he was on the set watching Mr. Rogers wrap up the show.
And he got to the end of the passage that he says all the time, "You're very special to me, and you know how? Just by being you, and I love you just the way you are." Well, my dear, I was standing there, and I swear to God, he was looking right in my eyes into my soul. I thought, well, no, Francois, you're so egotistical. You think he's talking to you. And I walked off the stage to the point where he was coming off. And we stopped in front of each other. And I said, "Fred, were you talking to me?" And he said, "Yes, I've been talking to you for 2 years, but you heard me today." Well, my dear, I became a wet Kleenex. I dissolved in his arms. I was so shocked and so happy. And I thought, my God, this man loves me. I must be somebody. I had never, ever experienced such pure, pure, unadulterated love. Finally, my prayers have been answered that somebody loved Francois. Oh, it was the most wonderful experience in my life. I've not had anything quite like it.
He is such a special person. Lots more of him on the podcast. But like I said, we also go down these kind of roads about the foods that he wants. So I'm not going to give the specifics, but for his last meal, Francois wants a variety of soul food. So I spoke with the soul food scholar. His name's Adrian Miller, and he talks about how foods like chitlins and okra came to the American South.
You know, a short list of things that come from Africa that we know are native to West Africa are things like watermelon, okra, black-eyed peas, hibiscus. All of these things come to the Americas to provision plantations because in many cases the enslaved were allowed to grow their own food on plantations. You know, you have to just remember, the enslaved were not thought of as human beings. They were thought of as commodities. And so slaveholders were just doing enough to keep people alive so they could make a profit off of them. And what they found out is that when they served the enslaved rotten European food, the mortality rates got so high that they were losing. It was a losing proposition. But they found that when they switched to feeding the enslaved the foods that they were used to from their part of West Africa, the mortality rates improved.
So like we said, this is a preview. I know.
I'm on an emotional roller coaster with you right now. First, I'm tearing up about Mr. Rogers, and now I just feel horrified and sickened by what I'm hearing here.
It's hard. I mean, he talks about the fact that slaves were fed in troughs like animals. They weren't allowed to eat with silverware because that could be used as a weapon. Yeah, and that's part of why I enjoy doing the show is learning about these things in history. There's so much more to food than just a meal. I mean,
you learn so much about the culture. And one of the things that continues to be an area of struggle in the South is cornbread. So some people use sugar in the batter when they make cornbread, and some people eat it unsweetened. And I always thought that was a geographical thing. It's actually whether you're black or white is how you like to eat your cornbread. So I interviewed a woman named Kathleen Purvis back in 2016. She wrote a piece for the Charlotte Observer titled, "Why Does Sugar and Cornbread Divide Races in the South?"
There's a tendency that people who are black tend to make a sweeter, cakier version of cornbread. People who are white in the South tend to absolutely resist the idea of sugar in cornbread. Their cornbread tends to be much coarser and definitely less sweet.
So there's a long history of why, but this is all a tease to force you to listen to the full episode where it all gets explained. So all you need to do is text the word cornbread, one word, text cornbread to 98973, and we will text you the episode. Text cornbread to 98973, or you can listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, anywhere you listen, or yourlastmealpodcast.com. I'm doing the weirdest thing with my hand right now. I'm like talking to you. It's like I'm a bird and I'm flying away.
How do you eat your cornbread?
You know, I grew up the way my dad made it. Was unsweetened, actually, but we would put honey on top.
I got to ask where my family recipe came from then.
You do.
You Thanks, do. Rachel.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.